Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode. I am excited to bring you a fantastic guest today. Dr. Nicole Viena is a forensic psychologist and expert witness based in LA. She worked for 10 years in correctional mental health within the Los Angeles County jails and juvenile halls before making the transition to private practice as an evaluator in 2015. Nicole is appointed to the Los Angeles County Adult Superior Court Panel of Psychologists and Juvenile Delinquency Panel of Experts. Her forensic areas of interest and expertise include malingering, trauma, neurodevelopmental disorders, and youthful offender evaluations in high-stakes cases. And that last one is exactly what we're talking about today. So we're chatting all about youthful offender evaluations, what they are, what they entail, why they're important, some history and context and case law surrounding them. So we cover a lot of ground here, and Nicole speaks with a nice kind of succinct manner that is also quite warm and educational at the same time. So fantastic interview. Really enjoyed this one, especially in an area that I don't know much about. So if you're a forensic practitioner or just interested in forensic evals of this type, stick around. I think you will learn quite a bit this time. All right. Without further ado, let's transition to my interview with Dr. Nicole Viena. Hey, Nicole, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Jeremy, thanks for having me.
Yes, of course. It's good to see you.
Good to see you as well.
Thanks for coming on. So we've known each other for a little while now, maybe a year. I don't know. Time goes by fast.
Yeah.
Yeah. And before we totally dive into the topic and content for today, I'll give a little plug for your own podcast, which is specifically focused on the forensic world.
That's right.
Definitely recommend people check that out. I'll put the link in the show notes and everything. But I'm going to pull just a little slice of your expertise today for our general testing podcast. So tell me, you know, I always like to start with why this is important. So yeah, why this? I mean, out of everything you could do in psychology or in assessment or even in forensics, like why this?
Right. This is important to me because I truly believe, and this is obviously backed in science, that juveniles or adolescents are fundamentally different from adults. So we can't treat them the same as we do adults in the criminal justice system, hence why they have their own system, the juvenile justice system. And on a personal note, I have a sibling that went through the juvenile justice system, had some mental health issues, and I really got to see from an insider perspective on how the system treated minors at the time. And this was like several years ago. This was like in the 90s. And you know, definitely shifts and changes every couple years, depending on laws and statutes and where you're at in the country, of course. They're different. But I got to see what it was like for the family to go through that and the, you know, my sibling, you know, himself. And I thought, wow, like there needs to be a lot of work done here. And we really need mental health experts to come in and, you know, help educate the Trier effect, help educate the attorneys and really, you know, produce more research in the area of adolescent brain development. That's so important in terms of sentencing for juveniles.
So, sure.
Personal and professional interest.
That's usually what it is for a lot of us, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was interesting too, growing up, because I came from a law enforcement family. So it was like very interesting, right? You got two sides of the coin, both, you know, in the household, and it's like, whoa, it was quite interesting.
Oh, I bet. I cannot even imagine what those conversations might have looked like or sounded like.
Lots of debate in the household. And to take it another step further in my current adult life, I'm married to a police officer now. So
right.
so much more interesting conversations now happen at the dinner table.
Right. You're living it.
Yes.
I mean, so this might be off script a little bit, and feel free not to answer if you don't want to. That's totally fine. But what were some of the things that you noticed with your sibling, you know, going through this process? Can you remember like anything that stuck with you right off the bat that you thought to yourself, this needs to be different, or this isn't fair, or I don't like this, anything like that?
Yes, it was partly, I think I want to say the time that it, that stands out most to me is in sentencing for juveniles. Mm. In my sibling's case, there really wasn't much consideration into some of the factors that we see that are really important to look at in youth, like their immaturity and the family home environment. So that was the biggest one. Like, it just wasn't talked about. It was just a lot of blame. And there wasn't much consideration about why this behavior was happening. It was just, this happened, now there's a consequence.
Mm-hmm. That's it. So no consideration of circumstances or other factors, right?
Right, exactly.
Would you say, and I'm just going to give the caveat, you know, as with any area that is outside my area of expertise, and this certainly is, I will ask a lot of potentially dumb questions. So bear with me, and, you know, audience, bear with me. But do you feel like there are differences there in terms of consideration of circumstances, environment, et cetera, when you compare adolescents or juveniles to adults? I mean, do you think the standards should be different for adults compared to juveniles?
Yes, because what we know from neuroscience, right, is that the brain is different. You know, we see in research that the brain isn't fully developed until age 25. And in the past 10 years of research I've reviewed, there is even more research now that points to the brain not being fully developed until closer to 30, like the late 20s. So, you know, kids are just fundamentally different from adults. And, you know, that is exactly what the APA, along with the American Psychiatric Association, and I believe it was the National Association of Social Workers, that got together and did an amici brief for the court in a significant case where they cited this exact language, that the brain of a juvenile or an adolescent is fundamentally different from adults. And therefore, you cannot hold juveniles or adolescents to the same standards. When adults have, their brains are, you know, fully developed, and kids just aren't because of many factors.
Sure. Well, I know that we're going to dig into lots of things.
I don't want to jump too far ahead.
I know. I'm getting ahead of myself too. I always do this. But so let's back way up. And a lot of this will be for me, but hopefully for the audience as well. Just setting some groundwork. So when we say youthful offender evaluations, can you just define that? What exactly are we going to be talking about for the next hour or so?
Right. So youthful offender evaluations can mean a lot of different things across the country, especially in forensic work. We're always giving that disclaimer that things can vary by state and even county or the jurisdiction you're in, right? Because it's guided by case law. And of course, you know, constitutional law, which we all know constitutional law is the same across the board, but statutes and case laws are not. So youthful offender evaluations are pretty much those evaluations where an evaluator is doing a comprehensive mitigation type of evaluation. We in California tend to refer to these as Franklin hearing evaluations because it follows a significant court case, you know, the Franklin court case, which piggybacks off the Miller court case. Okay, so Franklin court case was in California. The Miller case, I believe, happened in Alabama. So we are looking at youth who have committed a very serious crime. And, you know, again, different states have different laws and different ways of sentencing, but I can speak for California. And we've had so many changes, even in Los Angeles County. where this has been different, but basically a Franklin hearing is where a Franklin hearing evaluation is where we are evaluating the youth and looking at the different Miller, what we call the Miller factors at play that could potentially have a significant impact on their sentencing. So it's a youth that has committed a serious crime, you know, such as murder, that might be tried either in adult court. Us in California right now, specifically in Los Angeles, no juveniles are being tried in adult court for anything. And that was through one of our Prop 57 passages. And then specifically in LA County, our new district attorney has said, we won't even have a consideration of them being tried in adult court. They are just going to be tried in juvenile court, and that is it. So we're putting together this really mitigation packet for a future parole hearing. So this youth will eventually get a parole hearing, and the board, the parole board, and some others at, you know, I guess involved with the state and some psychologists will eventually look at this packet, and they'll want to see, you know, the growth that has happened or the lack thereof, the maturity, you know, those kind of things, you know, rehabilitation potential, you know, so they can be considered for release from prison at some point.
Gotcha. I have a couple questions to clarify. And again, if you don't know, that's totally fine. But how common is that across the country for there to be a blanket statement that juveniles are not tried in adult court?
Are you asking, is it common?
Is it common? Yeah. Like, is that unique for LA County or California to not?
No, there are some states and some jurisdictions where juveniles are not tried as adults. In a lot of the states, before our new DA came in, they followed what we used to follow, which was that juveniles, before they're directly filed in adult court, district attorneys would have to have and the juvenile would have to have a hearing to be considered for the players to decide in the courtroom whether or not that kid or juvenile should be tried in adult court, if they're fit to be tried, right? We called them transfer hearings, at least here in California, or fitness hearings, if the juvenile is fit to be tried in adult court, or if they should be remanded to juvenile court for potential rehabilitation as a minor. So, you know, with some of the case laws, like the cases I was talking about, like the Miller case and the Franklin case, well, especially the Miller case, you know, the Supreme Court held that it was the Eighth Amendment that prohibits juveniles to be sentenced to life without parole. We call it LWOP, right? Life without parole, or their functional equivalent. So with that, you know, some states redid their juvenile sentencing policies for those significant crimes, and other states didn't. So it just depends on what state you're in. I'm not familiar with all the states, but I know California, we're a little more progressive, and we are really, the juvenile system is really focusing on rehabilitation.
Sure. Seems like it should. Just to my untrained eye.
You would think that, but like in these cases, like in the Miller case, for example, I mean, this kid was, if I remember correctly, oh my gosh, like he was 14. I want to say he's 14. He was 14 at the time. And, you know, he had these circumstances, right? You know, came from a home where I think his mom was an alcoholic. I don't know if dad was even in the picture. And he was basically in and out of the foster care system, right? And I think it was Alabama. It could be Arkansas, but it might be Alabama. I think it's Alabama. Yeah, Miller v. Alabama. So he was in and out of foster care, and he was abused, you know, so there's like significant child abuse cited in the court opinion. And he was using drugs and alcohol himself, just as his mom was, you know, noted to be an alcoholic. And there's these, I think there was like a boy or some boys that were trying to like sell drugs to his mom in their trailer or something. And so he, you know, followed the guy home with a friend and eventually, you know, killed him. And then, you know, left the scene, and I think he returned to the scene to try to cover up the evidence. And through that, he lit a fire. So he was charged with murder, I think in the course of arson or something along those lines. So he was 14 though. And, they tried him I think the district attorney filed directly in adult court. So he was tried in adult court, and murder in adult court holds significant ramifications, meaning you're going to get a sentence equivalent to, you know, the crime that you committed. So for a 14-year-old to get, you know, life in prison without the possibility of parole is pretty significant when the brain isn't developed, right?
Sure.
So, but that's what the court initially held until the appeals and so forth. So then, you know, through appeals, they, that's when they held that the Eighth Amendment, you know, says that you cannot sentence a juvenile to life without parole, life in prison without the possibility of parole, because it violates the Eighth Amendment. So okay. Then we have some case law, right? That we now it's changing, like how states are seeing juvenile cases.
Sure, sure. Yeah, it's interesting to kind of look back with the benefit of hindsight to say, oh, well, thank goodness, you know, that, of course that makes sense. You know, kid who's 12, 14, 16, gosh, it's just kind of remarkable and sad that that has not always been the case, right?
Right. And that's why case law is so important, especially in forensic work, to understand these cases, read the actual opinions.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So you know how to base your evaluation, how to start and formulate your evaluation for these kind of mitigation cases.
Yes. So I want to bookmark that. I would love to hear more about how deeply you dive into case law and you know, just legal opinion and things like that. I think that'll come up during the course of our discussion. I hope it does.
Yes.
In the meantime, though, I did want to ask, just to clarify, at what point in the process are you conducting these evaluations? So is this post-sentencing or pre-sentencing or post-incarceration? I'm not sure what the right term is. Yeah, where exactly are you doing these?
Adjudication, or like, are they get like on their way out? So in California, some of our youthful offender evaluations, right? Like I said, the Franklin hearing evaluations. So Franklin, let me just really quick, the Franklin case. So the Franklin case was a California case. And this was, again, and you can cut me off if the story is too long. I think it's just helpful to put it into context for people. Yeah. So Franklin, similar to Miller, okay? But he was 16. And he, you know, again, had circumstances that were going on in his life. He lived in a really impoverished, like violent community in the projects, I believe in like Richmond, California. And he had some kids that were just targeting him, and they were threatening his younger brother, I think. And somehow through all of that and some other factors, he ends up getting a gun from, I think, his brother or his friend. And he wants to protect himself. And then he wants to make a showing, I guess, you know, like, don't come mess with me or my family, et cetera, et cetera. And these were, I think in the case, they documented these kids that were targeting him as gang members. So he had like gang members picking on him and his family and threatening them. Anyway, so he ends up, you know, getting a hold of a gun, and he goes with a friend to threaten these kids, or, you know, do a show of like, don't mess with me. And through the course of that, he, you know, got out of the car that he was in, and he just shot at the person that kept, that was threatening his family and his younger siblings. So he just shot at him several times, and the kid died. I think he was a kid. The other kid died in the course of this, you know, action. So he was, same thing, you know, tried as an adult at 16. But, you know, what happened in his case is that they did uphold that, you know, in appeal, I think it's in the appeals court that they upheld his Eighth Amendment rights were not violated, because California, again, you have to pay attention to your state's, you know, penal codes and case law and statutes. So in California, there's another, this is why we dive deep into case law and stuff like that. In California, we have Penal Code Section 3051, I believe. I should have wrote that down. 3051. That says our parole boards here in California have to consider, you know, psych evals and risk assessments as part of like a, when they come up for release, like potential release. So that hearing that the Board of California Parole has for these youthful offenders, which I think comes around, gosh, I want to say they're 20, like age 25, somewhere around there, 23, 24, 25. So they have to consider the Board of California, the Board of Psychology in California. The parole board has to consider psychological evaluations and risk assessments to see whether or not this youth, well, maybe now an adult, has, you know, gained some maturity, you know, has rehabilitated in prison. They have to consider these things, right? So therefore, the Franklin case was, you know, the court said, no, it didn't violate his Eighth Amendment rights, because we have, you know, Penal Code 3051 that says he's going to get a hearing when he's like 25 to consider his release from prison. So there you go. And we just need to look at the psych evals and the risk assessments. Hence why attorneys, when they are going in for sentencing for these youths, so it's at the sentencing phase, but I have attorneys that contact me from the beginning because these evaluations can take a long time. So, but they're used at a specific hearing called the Franklin hearing, and it's really around the sentencing time. And it's really just so you can put, or so the attorney can put together a record of, you know, youth-related factors that, you know, may have impacted this juvenile at the time of his offense. They want to put together this, you know, kind of giant packet to be looked at in the future. So it may not even be looked at for like 10 years.
I see. Until they come up for that parole.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yep. I gotcha. Okay. So just again, for some context, how much time, I don't know, this probably varies, but what's the range of time that may have elapsed between the offense and the evaluation/sentencing process?
I mean, well, it depends on how quick your courts get through things, first of all. and with COVID right now, we're a little, you know, behind on things. But generally, I would say I'm getting appointed to my Franklin cases about a year after the sentence, like maybe 8 to 12 months. It just depends on how early the attorney wants it, or how early they want to start it. There are some retrospective kind of Franklin hearings, if you will. So because of our state bills and assembly bills that have passed, we are doing, you know, we're looking at offenders who were sentenced years ago, you know, maybe violating the Eighth Amendment rights, right? They were sentenced to life without the possibility of parole before all these case laws came up and before new propositions came up. And so they are now being looked at kind of retrospectively. So we may be evaluating someone that's, you know, 40, 50 years old, who was sentenced 17 to life in prison, right? So we're like looking way back. So you could get it then, and they're in prison, right? It's pretty trippy. You're looking way back.
Yeah, that seems very challenging for a number of reasons.
It poses a lot of potential challenges, you know, looking at records from back then. How reliable are they? You know, how much weight are you going to give to each source? Can you even get records?
Oh, of course. Yeah.
A lot of things.
Right. So it sounds like there, if I'm understanding right, there are, and you please tell me if this is off base, but it sounds like there are kind of two uses for an evaluation like this. It's coming into play there during the immediate, more acute kind of sentencing phase, and it's going to be held for down the road whenever they come up to possibly be released, to serve as almost like a baseline. Is that a good conceptualization, or would you change that?
Yeah, it'll serve as a snapshot in time when you're doing your mental status exam, for sure, which is really important. It is going to serve as kind of like a record of mitigating factors specifically related to youth. So we're doing this, like, look at what their brain looks like, where their brain's at the time of the offense, you know. So you're tying in a lot of neuroscience. You're really commenting on what we call the 5 Miller factors, or I think there's 4 or 5 Miller factors that you can count on. So things that are specific to youth at the time of their offense, like these ones I did write down so I didn't miss any of them. So First one, considerations of the juvenile's chronological age. So like how old they are and the relevant hallmark factors to that age, right? A 10-year-old is going to be different than a 14-year-old versus a 16-year-old versus a 25-year-old. So we want to look at their chronological age and things like immaturity, like failure to appreciate risk and consequences, family and home environment, like I mentioned earlier, really important, right? Because the juvenile can't get out of certain situations. Like they can't leave a dysfunctional household. I mean, maybe if the court removes them, but then they're dealing with, you know, possible dysfunction in the foster care system or child abuse, right? Like some of the, like the Miller kid. So we want to comment on all these different factors and also the kid's role in the crime. Like, did they play an immediate role, a supporting role? You know, were they influenced by their peers? Were they under the influence of drugs or alcohol? Or even if they weren't under the influence of drugs and alcohol, I mean, just by using drugs and alcohol at that time, we know that interrupts brain development in general. So even if they were sober at the time of their offense, I mean, it still plays a role. So we need to comment on that. And then last, of course, their potential for rehabilitation. It goes in a nice little packet and goes off with them. You know, goes in their parole file, and then it gets reviewed years later. Now, sometimes attorneys will retain us not to do specifically a Franklin hearing kind of evaluation, but nonetheless a youthful offender mitigation evaluation where they will use it to try to mitigate the sentence.
Okay.
So okay. Maybe it's not like a murder case, maybe it's, you know, but another significant case, maybe it's a carjacking case or an attempted murder case, where they aren't going to necessarily get sentenced to life in prison, but they're looking at significant time.
Right, right. So these evaluations may be used in the sentencing process. The results, yeah, could be considered.
Oh, absolutely. And that's why they're so important. It has the potential to impact that juvenile's life. Big time.
Yes. Oh, mm-hmm. Yes. That's a very important role. Are these matter of course? I mean, is this sort of standard of care for any case like this? I mean, is every youth in this situation going to get an evaluation like this?
In California, I know at least in LA County, it's pretty standard. I mean, if the attorneys aren't doing it, then that could be a problem down the road of possibly getting ineffective counsel. It is pretty standard out here. Like I said, though, these cases that where the inmates are 40, 50 years old, it didn't happen because we didn't have the case law at the time, or we didn't have the statutes, you know, in place. So, you know, attorneys are coming on the cases now saying, okay, we need to get this established. We need to get a Franklin hearing done. And it happens. They retain an expert and we go in and we do the evaluation and then they have it on record. So, and then they go back and I think it gets remanded to, you know, the sentencing court, and the sentencing court hears it.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you for providing so much background. I think that is important just to understand exactly when this is happening, why it's happening, where it comes from.
Right. Yeah, because it's out here, at least in California, it's kind of a new thing in the past couple years. You know? I mean, like I said, the Miller case happened in 2012. The Franklin case happened in 2016. Us people here in California, how we had Prop 57 pass a couple years ago, which meant that DAs were no longer allowed to directly file in juvenile court. So we had all this, you know, these new laws and cases passed. So it is fairly new. So when evaluators are being asked, even juvenile evaluators that work the juvenile court circuits, a lot of us, when we first started doing this, we're like, what is that? What do you want? What are you looking at? So we really had to dive into the cases and see what they upheld. And what are the factors that we should consider in the evaluation? Like, what do we need to comment on? What are we looking for?
Yes, yes. I think that's a nice segue to the practice of these evaluations. What do these actually look like? So I'd like to spend some time on the practice, of course, and like what this looks like clinically and how you conduct the evaluations and the report and everything. But I'd also like to spend some time before we wrap up, of course, on how to break into this area and how you might get referrals and just the kind of the business side of things. So yeah, let's start clinically though. What, well, Where do we start? Where do you start clinically with an evaluation like this?
Right. Good question. So clinically, you know, you are probably going to start collecting records. The attorney hopefully will get you what you need, but if not, it's always helpful to talk to someone that has done these evaluations so you know what records to request. You know, you'll collect all of that kind of stuff. You're going to want to interview the family, maybe treatment providers, and definitely the inmate or defendant or juvenile themselves, you know, depending on where you're getting retained in the case. If you're getting retained on the juvenile side where the adolescent's like 17, 16, or, you know, if it's someone, we're doing a retrospective one on someone that's 40 or 50 years old, you'll interview them. So usually the cases I've worked, my attorneys have retained a forensic social worker or a what they call an investigator, which is super helpful. So I actually tell the attorneys, if they can, get one of those on their cases, because the forensic social worker will go out and interview like the entire family. They'll also review records and they'll pull together, and the defendant or the juvenile, they will put together this really nice psychosocial summary for you, which is really important because we're looking at that as one of the factors. So they'll do that and you can just review it. And then of course, you know, you should probably do your own clinical interview, and it's up to you. Sometimes I know some evaluators will go back and re-interview family members and some won't. I do it on a case-by-case basis. If I feel the psychosocial is enough from the social worker, I won't. I may just consult with a social worker. Or if it's an investigator, usually they're retired, you know, police officers or detectives that are, you know, on some sort of panel and they do this investigation. It looks very similar to a social worker. A little less clinical, but it's essentially the same thing. You're getting information from all these sources. That's what they're doing. And I just play, like I said, case by case basis. If it's pretty thorough, I'll just consult with them. If it's not, and I have more questions as I'm reading through their psychosocials and there's gaps on pretty important things like trauma histories, you know, mental health history, family dynamics, family generational trauma, I'm going to go interview that person myself because I want that information. It's just another source. You know, we look at multiple sources when we make an opinion, you know, multiple sets of data. So you're going to spend a lot of time in that area. Now, because of brain development, incomplete brain development with juveniles, some attorneys want a full neuropsych done. So if you're not a neuropsych, no problem. They'll retain a separate neuropsych expert. If you happen to be a neuropsychologist or someone with a good amount of training in neuropsychology, they'll have you do it. So I have done full neuropsychs on my cases because I've had training in that. And you know, it really speaks to, you know, where their brain is at in development in terms of like executive functioning, the incentive processing system. And you can really show that, you know, in the data. So again, another source, right, to support a potential opinion.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's kind of where you start. So testing really just depends on what the attorney is asking for. If there's neurodevelopmental issues, of course, you know, the attorneys are going to ask for it. You know, if there's someone that has intellectual disability or, you know, special education in school, again, it's another mitigating factor that we need to talk about.
Of course, of course. So let me go back and break down those components a little bit. I'll go back to the beginning. So you said you're going to request records. So what records are you requesting? What's important?
I might be different from my colleagues on this, but I like to have a ton of records. It's the way I approach the ECCC too. I was very much like I couldn't have enough information. I just wanted to have it all. So I asked my attorneys to give me, for sure, I need school records. If they were involved out here, we call it Department of Children and Family Services. So it's like the child welfare system. I'll ask for those records like unredacted because sometimes they'll send it to you with big black blots because they block out like all this info about child abuse. And I'm like, no, I need that stuff. So unredacted DCFS records. I ask for juvenile mental health records. If they've been in an adult jail or prison, I ask for what we call their C file and their jail mental health records, which is a really great source of information because you're getting snapshots of their mental status through mental health records if they've been seen by a clinician. And that's really helpful to see, you know, where they were at in terms of maturity and, you know, overall brain growth or incomplete brain development, and where they are, you know, well, the person looking at them down the road for the parole hearing is going to be able to see whether or not they have, you know, potentially rehabilitated, you know, grown a little bit in terms of maturity. So it's really important to get those records and document that. So those are the big ones. I'll also ask for any, if it's neuropsych related, of course, I'm going to ask for all of those providers' records, like assessments. If it's special ed, I need the actual evaluations, not just the IEP notes. I want to look at what the psychologist said. And then any medical records that are relevant. I mean, I don't need a, you know, things that are irrelevant, you know, I don't need, but if it's related to the neuropsych diagnosis or neurodevelopmental disorder they have, I need it. I want to review it.
Of course.
So, yeah.
Yeah. I like records too. I always say, I agree with you. More information is better than less, because I just find I have so many questions when I'm doing evaluations, and it's helpful to at least have those sources of information. Then you can figure out if you need it or not.
Yeah. And you'll get the hours. If it's important to the attorney to have you review it, they'll give you the hours to review, which is nice.
Sure.
Sometimes attorneys will, I mean, I have mixed feelings about attorneys. Sometimes they'll say like, oh, I don't think you need to review all of it, just this page and this page. So I'm just going to send you, you know, page 5 and page 10, and they're skimming through the records. Some of my colleagues, I hear they like it because it really cuts down on their time, but I'm still responsible for the opinions I make. And I don't want an attorney to decide what's important, what's not in terms of psychological records, so, or mental health records. So I just say, I err on the side of caution. I just say, send them all to me. Can you get me the hours? And we go from there. Now, if we don't get the hours, then, you know, I'm going to make, you know, a note of that in my report that, you know, the court didn't approve the hours. Here's what I got. And I did, you know, here's a summary of what I could do in those hours.
That's good to know. Okay. Yeah. I would definitely want to circle back to the hours and how you fit this, you know, how you budget time for something like this. So
sure.
We'll pin that. So as far as the interview, you mentioned this a little bit, but sometimes that might be farmed out, it sounds like, to one of these forensic social workers, which sounds like a cool service. But yeah. What are you looking for in the interview? You mentioned, you know, trauma history. Like what is crucial to obtain during this interview?
Yeah, so we're looking at not just the mental status of how they are, you know, in front of you at the time, but we really want to look at those factors relevant to youth. Okay. So we want to look at the brain development. So that's where the neuropsych testing, some attorneys want that full, you know, full battery. Some, you know, sometimes maybe you'll just do some executive functioning stuff. You know, but you're looking at brain development. Okay. We're also looking at the big one, family and home environment. Like, what is it like where they're growing up at? Like, who are their adult influences, their caregivers? Is there any child abuse? Are they exposed to, you know, violence in their community? What peers are they hanging out with? We know adolescents are susceptible to peer influences. We want to know what's going on in their social lives. Trauma is really important. You know, we know from research, again, in neuroscience that, you know, child abuse, physical abuse, especially sexual abuse, significant repeated acts of this can cause changes in the structure and functioning of the brain. So we want to assess for that. We want to assess for generational trauma. You know, maybe it's happening because this is what's happened in the family for years on end. Again, the youth cannot really get themselves out of that situation. So how are we, you know, how are we supposed to hold them at the same level of accountability as an adult that has the choice to leave? So we're looking at those kind of factors.
Can I ask you a question real quick, Nicole?
Yeah.
And I'm generalizing here. Tell me if this is totally off base, but I could see with kids who are in these situations that it might be hard to get a hold of caregivers or parents or folks who can speak to some of these factors. I mean, do you find that's true, or are you able to get access to a lot of these individuals?
It can be difficult sometimes because parents might be, sometimes I, and in some cases, it's really rare. I haven't had any contact with parents because you don't know where they're at. You know, the kid might've been left or abandoned, you know, early on in their life and they've grown up in the foster care system. So we try to get, you know, maybe the clinicians that have been working with them, or if they have foster parents, even if you can get a hold of them, something we have to consider is the reliability and the weight that we give to their report. So that's why we want to look at multiple sources, not just maybe one parent, but, you know, two parents if we can, caregivers, grandparents, therapists, reports, you know, we want to look at it all. So it can be difficult.
Right, right. And another random question. I think when I talked with Chris Mulkey about custody evaluations, he mentioned, I think it was him who mentioned social media records. Do you ever consider social media records in some of these cases?
You know, I haven't asked for them on my list. And one of the next trainings I plan to go to is the social media, I forgot what it's called, but it's through the American Academy of Forensic Psychology. I think they have a workshop coming up of how to use social media in forensic evaluations, because that's just not something I've done. Now, I have had to review records that included social media accounts of juveniles in some of their cases because I have to look at discovery. It's in there. I haven't specifically asked for it, but I have seen some. Sure, and I think that would be important too. You know, again, it gives you kind of some insight depending on what the messages are, what's posted, I guess. It can give you some insight into what they're thinking, what's going on in their brain, you know, how they're making decisions or lack thereof.
Of course, of course. Yeah. And then as far as the testing, I don't know if there's a whole lot else to say about testing. I mean, it sounds like you're just trying to get a good sense of what their brains are up to. I mean, is there anything specific or any special considerations with these forensic evals from the neuropsych side?
I think the trainees that I've worked with, I mean, if they're asking for neuropsychs, it's usually because, like I said, the kid has had a history of being diagnosed with some sort of neurodevelopmental disorder. Like they had a prior history of regional center or, you know, the intellectual disability diagnosis, or they've had something in that area. So again, we're just coming in as the neutral third parties to confirm those results and seeing where they're at now compared to where they were at before. So as a neuropsychologist, right, you're looking at, you know, pattern of, you know, brain dysfunction or deficits and seeing if that correlates with some behaviors, maybe specifically in our cases, you know, how it is related to the crime-related factors that are going on. And for youth specifically, I mean, we're looking at, you know, the frontal lobe, that's really important, right? Because it's the last to come online and develop. And, you know, more connections happen as we get older. And so we're looking at how they're making decisions, reasoning and judgment, you know, their, you know, inability to look to the future and process, you know, long-term consequences or consider long-term consequences, you know, all the things that your frontal lobe does, not quite online yet with adolescents. So
yeah.
We're looking at all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, that seems super important.
And ability to modulate emotions. I mean, we can't forget that. I mean, even in adults, I'm looking at that. But, you know, we're looking at, can they regulate? Can they modulate? Like, what kind of coping skills do they have or lack thereof?
Right, right. Yeah. Now, I don't necessarily know that we need to dive deep into battery selection. That feels like a big can of worms to open. But, you know, anything to stay away from, or are you using kind of like standard, you know, Wechsler instruments, you know, personality, MMPI, MCM, Mackey, you know, that sort of stuff?
Yeah. I mean, in short, yeah, it definitely is a can of worms, right? I think I have talked to some of the child custody evaluators. It's like the same thing with them, but definitely in forensics, we're using, you know, measures and instruments that meet the Frye and Daubert standard, meaning that, you know, they're used by people in our field and they have, you know, good, hopefully they have good, you know, reliability, inner rate or reliability. So you want to kind of stick with those. And I am using standard Wechsler measures in mine. So I'm using the Waste often, the Whisk and the Rat. And in my neuropsych batteries, you know, I tend to do like full comprehensive neuropsych batteries. So that, I mean, that's a long list of tests, but again, they've all passed the Fry-Dahlberg standard and considered scientifically sound by our community. So no problem there. You know, personality measures is a very big can of worms, especially with juveniles. Attorneys, at least in my experience, do not like them because, you know, if a juvenile hits, even adult, you know, you give an MMPI to an adult and they hit on the antisocial scale based on their behaviors. Well, if, you know, any district attorney that sees that is like, oh no, like no go. Like they're, you know, quote bad. They're not capable of rehabilitation, right? Because you can pull up research, you know, personality disorders are the hardest to treat. So they don't want you to give personality measures. Now, I tell my attorneys that sometimes, you know, it can be very helpful. It could be very helpful in terms of diagnostic clarification. It could be very helpful, especially if we're doing a risk assessment. If you want this, if you want me to consider, you know, whether or not this person can be a danger to society if released, I mean, we kind of need some of these clarifications, you know, so sometimes we will even give a PCLR. I mean, we have to have a good amount of sound data here. So I talk to the attorneys and they're usually pretty open to it. Most of them are going to know where their clients are going to hit at anyways. So they kind of already know, and better to have, you know, a good evaluation than just one that's going to make them feel better. Cause that's not going to help them in court. It's right. Gonna make them feel bad. And they know that. So, I mean, I've worked with some really good attorneys. They're pretty open to what I suggest. They trust my expertise, if you will.
Sure. Yeah. Good. They should. So tell me about the report. What does your report look like? Is this lengthy? Is it brief? What are the important components? And I think most importantly for me, what kind of recommendations or opinions are you offering at the end?
Yeah. So my youthful offender evaluations, whether it is specifically for the Franklin hearing or it's just purely for sentence mitigation on maybe a less serious offense than murder, like we talked about earlier, mine are pretty comprehensive because these are so important in juvenile court. And I do comprehensive evaluations because I explain the importance of them to the attorneys and the attorneys pretty much know. So I make sure that I get the hours needed to be able to do a comprehensive evaluation. So I don't have any factors barring me from, you know, wanting to include everything that needs to be included and give myself enough time. So they are pretty lengthy reports. They're some of my longest reports as compared to like maybe a competency evaluation. You know, those evaluations for me are like maybe 3 pages, maybe 4. A youthful offender mitigation type of evaluation, I mean, mine minimally are running 10 pages. I don't think I've done one more than 15 pages. And when I say 15, that's because we're doing a full neuropsych. So I'm integrating my results. I'm not doing it like a standard clinical eval where I'm, you know, here's what test I use, here's what the test data said, and then down here I'm going to repeat that, summarize it, right, in the opinions. I'm just integrating that into my opinion. So right. 15 pages, I can get you out of neuropsych in there. Now, it could even be longer if you're attaching a full risk assessment too. If they want, you know, can this person, you know, be safely released into the community? What's their risk of reoffending? You know, you're attaching a risk assessment on that may make it longer too. So, but mine typically are about 15 pages, 10, 15 pages.
Yeah. Yeah. And what are the primary components in that report? Well,
primary components, of course, in mine, you're listing, you know, your relevant sources of information, like where you pulled, you know, data from, listing the records that you reviewed. I include in mine the, you know, I've gave the defendant or the juvenile informed, you know, consent, or they've did an informed assent. You know, most of the time I get court orders, so they're court ordered to participate. I mean, they have the right not to, and we go over all that and the limits of confidentiality. So I have a little blurb that explains that, and then I also include somewhere in there, just at the outset of my report, why, you know, the referral question. I guess in clinical practice you'd call it a referral question. So it's similar in forensic reports, and I cite, you know, kind of why we're doing a Franklin hearing evaluation or a useful offender evaluation and relevant, relevant case law or statutes, just to explain what I'm doing. And it also helps keep me within the referral question, right? I'm not trying to go too outside of the referral question. I'm staying within the scope. So that's important. You should have something in your report that covers that. And then after the sources are listed, I've changed my reports like in the past couple months. Mm. So I used to do a whole background information section like you would do in clinical practice, right? So we've got, birth history, developmental milestones, mental health, school history, whatever, et cetera. Now I've almost changed that, and I followed practice by another colleague of mine who told me all about this findings-based report, which has now been, I guess it's a workshop by some folks in the American Academy of Forensic Psychology. We're moving towards these kind of these different like approaches to reports to kind of streamline them, make them like very concise to the point where we're not repeating information. So I've incorporated, it was really hard. It was really hard because I'm like, no, like I want to include everything, I'm very detail oriented. So I'm like, I don't want to miss anything, but changing to that made me, realize, yeah, I'm not missing anything. I'm just not including things that aren't relevant to the factors I'm looking at, right? The Miller factors, like the use, family background and the home environment and their brain development. I'm not missing anything because I'm addressing that in finding number one. So, I'm looking at all these factors that we mentioned, right? The Miller factors, and I address each one of them in a bullet point. So if the kid came from like a, impoverished, violence-ridden community, I'm going to write that, and this is not in any particular order, but I'll write that, finding one, so-and-so grew up in an impoverished neighborhood exposed to community violence. Then I'll list out what I normally would have put in like maybe this like social section of the report. I'll list it all right there and that's it. So I'm not doing any opinions in that first section. I'm just listing my findings. So same thing if we're including a risk assessment or a the neuropsych testing, right? I'm going to list my findings here. Boom, boom, boom. In the next section, I'm going into my opinion section. And then I comment on each one of those findings. So if I had five findings, based on the Miller factors, I'm going to have five, different opinions. I mean, it's all going into one grand opinion because at the end, I'm doing like a 1-2 paragraph summary. Mm-hmm. Again, integrating it and tying it into neuroscience research. Everything, should be based in that. There's some really great sources I think you'll list in show notes of people to read their research on adolescence and, juvenile brain development. But anyways, so I'm listing my findings, then I'm going into a different section about opinions, and then I have a summary section that kind of ties it all together.
Great.
Those are the important parts. And it's really a streamlined approach. But before I would list out a whole background section, and now it's like, okay, we're going to shorten this up.
Yeah, I like that. I like that. So if someone wanted to learn more about this findings-based approach, how could we, could you just Google findings-based report writing or what, where is that?
Not to my knowledge. I don't think so. I heard about it from a colleague that does forensic work as well. And I signed up for the class through the American Academy of Forensic Psychology. They do a report writing class quite often. And I think I did two of them from two different experts, and they provided us samples of what that looked like for them. And then I, of course, tailored it to my state and county because, of course, I have different, case laws and statutes that we abide by than they do because they're in different states. And then I incorporated my, informed consent kind of blurb and stuff. So I made it my own, but I took kind of the skeleton from like do a findings-based, section, and then do an opinion section, and then do a summary.
Right. So
take the class. I mean, you'll get, it's like some are 4 hours and some are 8 hours.
Okay.
Great information. And
yeah,
sample work.
I'm very intrigued. Yeah, I'll put that in the show notes. We'll dig around and try to find one of these classes or a link to the AAFP.
Yes.
And see if we can, help people find that. That sounds very intriguing. So it sounds like a lot of the report is driven by these Miller factors. You know, you're sort of investigating or, you know, looking at those in the background and the history or the findings and your opinion. Are you writing an opinion for each of them, even if they're not relevant? I don't know if that's the right word to use, but I mean, are you addressing all four or five in every one of these evaluations that you do?
Yes.
Okay.
And usually in my experience, the kids or the juveniles that I get, and even the adults, I mean, most of them, I mean, that I've evaluated have all of the factors. Now, if they don't, then okay, then I won't comment on it. I guess, if it's not relevant, then don't, you won't comment on it. In my experience, I haven't had one person yet that has not had anything in one of those areas. Somebody said, a forensic psychologist, and I can't remember his name right now, but he said that, and it just stuck with me, but he said, every person that is in the criminal justice system has experienced trauma, but not every person that has experienced trauma is in the criminal justice system. So, I mean, I found that to be largely true.
Just anecdotally, it seems like it would hold true. I'm sure you know the research better, but yeah, it seems, yeah.
Right, which is why it's important to really read the research by Steinberg and some of these others, like Elizabeth Kaufman, who does a lot of work in, you know, incomplete brain development with youth, and then what the trends are with crime committed earlier than later, and all those kind of factors are important.
Of course.
We're going to support your opinions in the opinion section. So when we're writing about, you know, Johnny was abused by his father and then sexually abused by a cousin and an uncle, we want to look at the research that is behind, you know, child abuse, sexual abuse, and what the correlations are to different kinds of crimes and offending. And you can make a really good sound opinion if you know the science behind that or the research behind that.
Sure. So speaking of the opinion, just to sort of close the loop with the report, can you, I don't know, give a ballpark of sorts or an approximation of what this summary opinion might sound like? Like, what are you putting in those final couple paragraphs? Generally speaking, like what's the tone or, you know, content of that?
I would say, I mean, the tone is neutral. I would say, I mean,
sorry, maybe tone is not the right word. What's the, it's aggressive. It's very, very provocative. No, sorry. Tone is not the right. What's the general content? Maybe we'll just stick with that. Like, what are you communicating in those last couple paragraphs?
Yeah, we're basically summarizing the youth history, and we're summarizing the relevant factors, if not all five that are present, but you're summarizing the relevant factors and their tie to brain development, their potential for rehabilitation. It's just a giant summary, and you really want to base it, like I said, in the research. And so what I use is I actually parallel it and quote some of the amici brief that the APA wrote. So they made some pretty strong statements. And of course, they put together this nice packet, you know, for the courts of adolescent brain development. So, I mean, I am citing these things in my summary. I'm tying what I found in that youth and the relevant factors to what we know in the research about brain development.
Gotcha.
Yeah. Gotcha. And then maybe you might be speaking to their, you know, risk of reoffending if that's a secondary question asked by the attorney.
Okay. Yeah. I was curious how firm you might be with these opinions.
Well, I mean, firm. I mean, yeah, you have to be, if you're citing them, you better be confident.
Yes.
You know, when we're making a comment on risk, you know, you're using structured professional judgment tools like the HCR 20 or the SAVORY if you're, evaluating a kid under 18, but basically you're looking at, you know, historical factors that aren't going to change. They're just present, you know, in the history. You're looking at clinical factors that might be a little bit more dynamic, and you're looking at, you know, risk management factors. So you're using tools, you know, to support, you know, structured professional judgment tools to support your opinions, not just saying like, I think that Johnny will have a medium risk. Like, no, it's tied to, it's going to be tied in the data and in the research.
Right. Right. Okay. Well, let's see, let's talk a little bit about the business side of things. So yeah, for someone, I mean, let's assume someone has the training to do these evaluations. We'll just let that be a given. How does one launch a practice around this? Like, who are you connecting with? Where do you get the referrals? What does that look like?
So I started my practice. It was a clinical practice, and I was seeing clients for therapy, and I was forensically trained. So I was just doing forensic evaluations on the side, building, I guess, that kind of a practice. I think I started out by making connections through my practicums and my internships. So because I went to a forensic program, I really geared all my training towards obtaining forensic sites. So I did practicums at the jail, internship, postdoc in the juvenile justice system. And through that, I met, other clinicians that had gone into private practice that had previously worked at the jail. I met and worked with different judges because we had certain programs in the jails I worked in where we had to evaluate. We did some evaluations with folks that were incompetent to stand trial. We did more of the restoration side of it. So you have to write reports to the court, interact with attorneys. So you make the connections there. And then from there, I waited my time. You have to, in our county, you have to have 5 years. I think you have to be licensed for 5 years or postdoc for 5 years to be able to apply to be on the court panel. And when you're on what we call the court panel, you're on this list where attorneys, public defenders, district attorneys, because you can get retained on both sides, and I do. And you can be listed on here. And then that's where the attorneys often look to pool their experts to come in and do these evaluations. So from there, then I also have met some private defense attorneys because they maybe used to work at the county public defender's office, or they were a former district attorney and they saw my report. So when they have their own firm now, they're like, hey, can you come take a case from us? So just building slowly, that's pretty much how I built my practice. I think like I opened my practice in 2015. I got on the panels in like 2017, and then it just took off from there. And now I'm, turning the corner now and doing a little bit more private defense work, but still a lot with, the district attorney and the county public defender's office. And I'm largely based in LA. I'll do evaluations in the surrounding counties because I'm like very close to Riverside, San Bernardino, and Orange County. Everyone in LA knows these counties. So I'll go that way and do my evaluations, for who calls first, and I put them in order and in my calendar. And that's pretty much how I do things.
Sounds good. Well, it reminds me, it just keeps coming back. It's like build relationships and do good work. And that helps.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I probably worked harder than I ever had at any agency job when I first started my practice, even now, but now it's just, you have a little bit more help if you hire staff and, you get a team put together.
Of course.
Makes things run smoothly.
Right. Right. Well, this has been super helpful. It's just personally interesting to me to be able to talk about an area that I don't know much about. And I'm hoping that other folks, forensic folks out there, are taking away a lot of information from our discussion.
Yeah. If I could add just one more thing. So not just applying to be on your court panels and starting there or working private defense firm cases, but you also want to get the appropriate training, especially for these evaluations. If you're working with juveniles, I mean, a lot of times we'll see reports by psychologists that work solely with adults, and they really miss the big points about incomplete brain development. So it's really important that you not only have, forensic training, like knowing how to administer certain forensic measures or assessments, and then just our general clinical measures and assessments, but you also have enough training in adolescent you know, brain development and adolescence in general, you know, knowing about the maturity issues and the things that happen during development. So having that plus your clinical expertise, you know, really allows you to make opinions that are, you know, like I said, based on the science and, you know, ethically sound. So get the training from, you know, sources like Concept and the American Academy of Forensic Psychology, the APLS. You want to get adequate training and, of course, you know, consultation or supervision from people that are already doing these evaluations. So that piece is really important.
Thank you so much for highlighting that. Yeah, I think that's, you know, I think a lot of us hear about different areas of practice and it's easy to get excited and want to leap into things. And it's so important just to make sure that you're doing so ethically and with solid training. Right.
Right.
Well, let's see. I think we'd be remiss if we didn't mention two more things. I mentioned your podcast at the beginning, but can you just tell people what exactly what the name of it is and what kind of stuff you talk about on your podcast?
Sure. Yeah. I have a podcast that I started a couple months ago, might have been even last year. It's called the Forensic Psychologist Podcast. And it is a podcast that I started really to help educate and support students and early career psychologists going into the fields of forensic psychology. I started it because I was getting a lot of emails from students, you know, across the country that had just found my website, or I hire interns and psych assistants throughout the years. So of course my ads, whether it's on like LinkedIn or, you know, Indeed, they're finding and they're like, oh, I'd love to do this, but I don't know what I need to have education wise to be able to apply for this. I mean, clearly in my job description, I'm like, you need to be this, this, and this, but you know, so I'm like, there's so many questions and I'm like, wow, like how come we're not talking about this? And how come even students in grad programs know very little about the field of forensic psychology? So I thought, hey, let's put out some information and really give people what they're looking for in one place. So I have a couple episodes out. I think we're on like episode 10, and I really do it about like once a month because, you know, forensic practice, we're so busy, but I try to get out at least one a month, sometimes two if we're lucky. And we talk about, I say we, sometimes I have guests, sometimes I do it myself. So we just talk about different kinds of forensic evaluations and go over the basics. Like it's a really, we do broad overviews. I plan in maybe season two to kind of go a little bit more in depth, but I just wanted to introduce the kind of forensic evaluations that we do. So I've done some interviews on like these Franklin hearing evaluations, competency evaluations, child custody evaluations we have in the works, and immigration evaluation. So all different kinds of forensic evaluations, like kind of like how you interviewed me, broad overviews, what kind of training do you need? What kind of like ethical considerations, you know, are there, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
We talk about that stuff. A little bit about the business side. We'll get into that more maybe season two. Everyone I've interviewed has graciously agreed to come back. So I'm like, I will call you. I'm going to call you.
Yes. I know. When you get a good guest, you want to lock them in.
I'm going to do a roundtable, hopefully, and we're going to discuss the business because it's a little different than clinical practice. And, you know, my systems changed completely when I did my forensic practice full-time and dropped my clinical caseload. So it's a little different.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to totally leverage this to ask you to come back and talk about the business side of a forensic practice.
Yeah, I'd love to. That'd be awesome.
Awesome. And the second thing that we got to mention is that you were a master scuba diver. So
yes,
not related to forensic practice at all, but pretty cool. So just wanted to acknowledge that. And I'm curious how you chose to do that and how much time you're putting into that these days.
I'm an avid scuba diver. I got certified when I was 18 on a study abroad trip in Australia. So got certified out at the Great Barrier Reef before it got destroyed. I mean, it's growing back now, but it took a pretty big hit over the past couple years. And I got into it just because I grew up by the beach. I love the water and, you know, there's a whole world underneath the ocean. And since then I've achieved certain different certifications. And now I'm kind of at the top you know, I maxed out, I guess, at the rec dive level. So I'm a master scuba diver. I have completed a rescue diver course, specialties, et cetera, et cetera. And I am actually doing photography now underwater. So if anyone finds me on Instagram, it is a nice blend of forensic related, you know, topics plus my scuba diving photos. And people are like, how do these two go together? But here's how. Here's how. Because, you know, just as clinicians that work with people that have trauma or just people in general, you know, in forensic work, we do a lot of evaluations, a lot of work if you're on the treatment side with people that have experienced, you know, so much in their life. You know, we hear about, we see human suffering, and you have to have a way to process that. And, you know, for me, having scuba diving vacations, or I live locally to the beaches, so I'm able just to jot down there, which is nice. It helps kind of provide some balance and some, you know, I guess, I don't know, lightheartedness to the work I do, right? It's a break from carrying all the trauma. You're seeing, you know, you're going out in the water, all the beautiful things underneath. It actually helps with anxiety too. Learning how to scuba dive. There's all kinds of
research. I can see that.
Yeah, there's all kinds of research on that and the breath work that goes into it. So anyways, but that's another. So the two are kind of connected. That's how I kind of break away. And I actually talk about it a lot with my attorneys, because they're like, I notice the young ones that come in, they're like, they're so inundated with the kids' trauma. And I'm like, you need to take some breaks sometimes. Like, I take a vacation every 3 months. Like, I may not go like on a big vacation, but I definitely take 1 to 2 weeks off every 3 months. And I just disconnect. So
I love that. I love that.
Yeah.
That's a nice note to end on. Take vacations, people.
Yes. My attorneys think, they're like, Nicole, you were just on vacation like 3 months. I'm like, I know, but do you know what we've been working on? Do you know how many murder cases we've had? I mean, I need the break. Like, you should take one too.
Absolutely.
But, yeah, it's good self-care. Yeah.
Well, I so appreciate your time and expertise and willingness to chat with me for a little bit. This is great.
Of course, anytime.
And your contact information, we'll put that in the show notes, of course. So if anybody wants to reach out, they can do that. Hopefully this is just round one, and maybe we'll talk again in the future.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
All right, everyone. Thank you so much for listening. As always, if you have not subscribed or followed the podcast, now's a great time to do so. Always grateful for those subscriptions and follows so that you don't miss any episodes that come out. And let's see, we are headed into the summer, got plenty more clinical episodes and business episodes coming up. So stay tuned and don't miss any of those. Like I mentioned at the beginning, if you need CE credits here as your license renews, ours renews every 2 years in August. So we are scrambling to get those CE credits. You can get those at athealth.com and just search for the testing psychologist. All right. Until next time, y'all take care. The information contained in this podcast and on the Testing Psychologist website are intended for informational and educational purposes only. Nothing in this podcast or on the website is intended to be a substitute for professional psychological, psychiatric, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please note that no doctor-patient relationship is formed here, and similarly, no supervisory or consultative relationship is formed between the host or guests of this podcast and listeners of this podcast. If you need the qualified advice of any mental health practitioner or medical provider, please seek one in your area. Similarly, if you need supervision on clinical matters, please find a supervisor with an expertise that fits your needs.